The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
So, what is it to trust God really? What I want to do today is talk about two different kinds of freedom. And bear with me as we spend a few minutes getting there. What is it to trust God really? I've written before that trusting the markets is simply another way of trusting God. Trusting the markets is simply another way of trusting God. And this is what I mean by that. Compare the markets to driving down the highway and the basic traffic regulations like drive on the right or maintain this speed are the laws that God has given to us concerning our financial lives. God tells us things like drive on the right side, don't go 90 miles an hour. So these are the laws that God has given us concerning our finances, our market-driven activity. Don't steal. Fulfill your contracts. Don't defraud. So as long as someone is driving on the right and is not careening down the road at 90 miles an hour, it is absolutely, absolutely none of my business where he is going or what snacks he might be eating on the way. I don't care. I shouldn't care what he picked up at the gas station 10 miles back. Was it a big gulp or it's none of my business. The economic control freaks don't want to agree on a few basic rules for the game. They want to determine the outcome of the game and every move by every player during the course of the game. They are, in short, aspiring to deity, something which in another era would have excited more opposition from Christians than it has now. Jumping back to the road metaphor, they want to not just have drive on the right and here's the speed limit. They want to say, now change lanes, now turn on your windshield wipers, now tap on the brakes twice. They want to control every last little thing. And you can't control every last little thing like that without trying to twist it out of God's hands. God's the one who currently controls those things. And if you're trying to control them, it's a coup. It's an attempted coup. So again, free markets, genuinely free markets, are not possible without free men. In other words, if certain men are slaves to sin, one sin that men get enslaved to is the desire for power, the desire to be as God, the desire to run everybody else's life. If you have a society full of free men set free by the gospel, then they're going to understand how that other guy across the way is also a free man and his liberties should be respected. And the person who respects that other man's liberty is able to do so because he's been set free from the sin of envy and power grabbing and so on. So free men are not possible apart from the saving power of the gospel. But this does not mean that the definitions of freedom in these two phrases are identical. It's not like having a brick and then putting a pile of them together to result in a brick wall. Freedom means different things on different levels, and this is what I mean by two different kinds of freedom. For a mistaken example, William Cavanaugh turns to Augustine for a definition of freedom, which is great if we're operating on the right level. That's great, but then he makes a very basic mistake when he fails to make the necessary adjustment between levels. So first, let me start with the agreement. Freedom for the Christian individual does not mean absence of restraint. Okay, libertarian freedom, where you want to tell everybody in the world that not to tell you what to do. All right, so that kind of radical anarchistic libertarian freedom is not for the Christian freedom. For the Christian, personal individual freedom is slavery to Christ. I'm not free unless I'm Christ's slave. As Dylan once said in one of his better moments of lucidity, you gotta serve somebody. True freedom before God is the freedom to do what is right as God defines what is right. So Augustine is exactly right here, and he's running on all Pauline cylinders. So Augustine says that true freedom is the freedom to do right. True freedom is the freedom to do the right thing, and you do the right thing because you're Christ's slave. All right, and he's running on all Pauline cylinders. This is what Paul argues in Romans 6, 14 through 20. Here, mark Paul's words carefully. For sin shall not have dominion over you, for you are not under the law, but under grace. What then? Shall we sin because we are not under the law, but under grace? God forbid. Know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are to whom ye obey, whether of sin unto death, or of obedience unto righteousness? But God be thanked that ye were the servants of sin, the slaves of sin. But ye have obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered you. Being then made free from sin, ye became the servants, slaves, of righteousness. I speak after the manner of men, because of the infirmity of your flesh. For as ye have yielded your members servants, or slaves, to uncleanness, and to iniquity unto iniquity, and to iniquity unto iniquity, even so now yield your members servants, or slaves, to righteousness unto holiness. For when you were servants of sin, you were free from righteousness. So, for Paul, being a slave to sin means that you're free from righteousness. Being a slave to righteousness means you're free from sin. Okay, so, but there is no place in Paul's universe where you can go to be your own autonomous little unit. If you are your own autonomous little unit, you are non-existent. There's no such thing. Everyone is either, back to Dylan, it may be the devil, it may be the Lord, but you got to serve somebody. Okay, so freedom from sin, the basic and foundational human freedom, is freedom to do what is right. If you're free from sin, you're free to do what is right. Not only so, but that doing right is defined by God and not by us. Freedom is defined by the perfect law of liberty, which is to say, freedom is defined by the law of God. So when I am exercising true freedom, I am keeping God's law with a whole heart. Okay? Now, so that means that if I define my personal freedom as slavery to righteousness, as slavery to Christ, clearly freedom there cannot be defined as absence of coercion. If I've got to serve somebody, it's just a question of who is my Lord, who is my master, not whether I have a master. So if I'm a slave to righteousness, and that is my freedom, you cannot define that state as absence of coercion, right? Because it's slavery to Christ, it's slavery to righteousness. But in a free market, in free market transactions, there is an absence of restraint. So if a man walks up behind me, say, in the produce section of Safeway, puts a muzzle of his gun behind my left ear, and makes me buy the oranges. Okay? He says, oranges are good for you. You won't get scurvy. Do it now. I am not conducting a free transaction. That is not freedom. I am being constrained by an outside force, and it doesn't matter if it's a thug who is trying to get his orange business off the ground, or if it's a health Nazi who's got my best interests in mind. You know, you need to eat more oranges. It doesn't matter if the person making me do it is nice or not. What matters is whether I have the option of buying the oranges or not. So, if he puts a gun behind my left ear, makes me buy the oranges, I am not conducting a free transaction, Augustine or no Augustine. The fact that I am forgiven, justified, and free from sin does not transform the coerced orange transaction or the coerced orange purchase into something else. A man who is free from sin can still be coerced in the marketplace. This should be obvious. Christians, freed from sin, can still be murdered. They can be arrested. They can be raped or robbed. The fact that I've been forgiven does not make my wallet inviolable. All right? So, Christians who are freed from sin, following Kavanaugh, following Augustine, they're personally free from sin, can still be robbed by the state. Naboth was a faithful Israelite. He knew the law. He knew his responsibilities under the law of God. He was a free man. Naboth was a free man. This did not prevent Jezebel from doing what she did, and Naboth's freedom from sin did not make it impossible for Ahab to sin against him. So Naboth is walking with the Lord, right? He's free from sin. He's got that true Augustinian freedom from sin going, and yet he's coerced, right? He has his vineyard is taken away. And Ahab, incidentally, would have been sinning against Naboth, regardless of what he called this theft by the state. There are lots of swell things he could have called it. Land reform, zoning readjustments, eminent domain, or perhaps communitarianism. Right? Well, Naboth, we have to be communitarian in our approach to this. Well, flip this around. So I've got a free man, a righteous Israelite, who is coerced in the market. That's one thing. You can flip it around. A bunch of slaves to sin, a bunch of slaves can set up a free market for a time in which they sell chains to one another at market rates. Okay? If the price of cocaine is not rigged, then the market will set the price according to the demand, just like it does with bread and butter. The price of cocaine is adjusted by market forces, supply and demand, in just the same way that the price of unrestricted price of bread and butter is adjusted. So here the market is free, but the consumers aren't. So if it's a bunch of cocaine addicts selling cocaine to one another, the market may be free. Nobody's making anybody do anything. But the individuals involved are slaves to their own passions and lusts. In the previous scenario, the consumer is free, but his transaction is not. Here, the transaction is free, but the consumers are not. Well, what gives? Well, clearly, we're using the word freedom in two different ways. What Kavanaugh misses, and I think he misses in a spectacular way, is the difference between meum and tuum. The difference between meum and tuum. When God saves me and releases me from servitude, and I begin serving him freely and happily, God has done something that only God can do. But if I turn to my brother and say, here, let me require of you what only God could give to me, I'm not expanding Pauline liberty. I'm distorting it and misapplying it. And I'm giving it an obnoxious smell. I am not exporting liberty. I am becoming a petty tyrant. So if God can make me free by giving me a new heart, I don't get to try to make my neighbor free by me giving him a new heart, because I don't have the capacity to give him a new heart. All I could do is mess up his old one. You know, I'd just wreck his life. So what do I mean when I say that only free men can produce free markets? I mean that one of the sins that God deals with us, that God deals with in our hearts, is in the process of our sanctification, is the sin of being an officious busybody. This is difficult because it is a besetting sin for religious types. The conviction that something is a sin transitions seamlessly into the serene confidence that that same something should be a crime. Okay, we're going to look at this more closely later, but there's a big difference between a sin and a crime. Okay, is it a sin to be a Donatist? Clearly. And so the magistrate should start hitting Donatists on the head with a knob stick. Or is it a sin to covet? Yes. But I don't want the sheriff's department or the police department or any legal department to set up a covetousness department. They don't have the ability to check the human heart. Is lust a sin? Yes, lust is a sin. Is the magistrate competent to deal with lust and make it a crime? Well, clearly not. There are all sorts of things that are sinful, and God will arraign them as sinful on the last day and will judge them as sinful, but they ought never to be made against the law. Okay? Something that is something should be a crime when it spills over into action that objectively wrongs or hurts someone else. So covetousness is a sin but not a crime. And stealing is a sin and a crime. Stealing is a crime because I have taken somebody else's car. I've taken somebody else's stereo. I've stolen their stuff. So, the slaves to sin who sell chains to one another at market prices are not going to be able to do that for very long. This is because they are foundationally selfish. Every one of them is foundationally selfish, and some of them will figure out how they could best use these circumstances to rip off the others. In other words, as they're selling chains to one another, somebody's going to say, I don't want to be a cokehead. I want to be a king of the cokeheads. I want to not abuse drugs. I want to manipulate them. And so I'm going to stop using coke, and I'm going to start saving up my money, and I'm going to manipulate this, and I'm going to turn it into a situation where I can enslave these people. And because they are enslaved to their lusts, they are going to be put up a very poor resistance to what I'm doing. Rigging the markets is one of the best ways to do that. But in the meantime, before this tyrant takes over the temporary free market that slaves to sin set up, you know, I'm talking about the free market that was set up on the pirate island, you know. So all the pirates landed on the island and they set up a free market system. That free market system will not last, okay? It will not last. But in the meantime, when someone buys cocaine or child porn or a gun to shoot his grandmother, that transaction, considered in isolation, could be considered a free transaction. He goes into a store and buys a gun. He goes into a shop and buys a magazine. You could just photograph that and say he handed over the money, he took the product, he walked out. That looks like someone conducting any number of other free transactions. A man buying a gun to murder his grandmother might look exactly the same as a man buying a gun for a lawful purpose to protect his family, let's say. So, considered in isolation, that transaction could be labeled a free transaction, but that is a temporary anomaly. That market will not be free for very long. Give it 15 more minutes. The whole thing is going to be controlled, and controlled badly. But the religiously officious are not much better and are frequently far worse. C.S. Lewis says somewhere that he would rather live under robber barons who are in it for themselves alone, he says, for their avarice will sometimes sleep. Robber barons get tired. Robber barons have to go night-night. He would rather live under robber barons, he said, than under moral reformers who believe that they are spreading sweetness and light with all their regulations. All right, so the moral reformers are spurred on by their conscience, and so they work much more diligently. They work harder and longer hours. A robber baron just squeezes you, and then he goes to bed. The moral reformer never sleeps. Take a look, for example, at the global warming zealots, who will brook no discussion and no opposition, for they are engaged in the high and lofty calling of saving the world. That's the reason why they're such a nuisance. They're saving the world. If someone just wanted control of this territory, he's not gonna be getting into making you adjust the temperature of your tap water or how long you take a shower, or, you know, something like that. So learning from the great Augustine does not have to include repeating his mistakes. I think Augustine has it exactly right on the personal level, but it's a mistake of the first order to take that Augustinian definition of freedom and try to apply it to market transactions, because there, freedom really is the absence of restraint.
New St. Andrews College thanks you for listening.